You're listening to the CyberWire Network, powered by N2K.
And now, a word from our sponsor, Zscaler, the leader in cloud security. Cyber attackers are using AI in creative ways to compromise users and breach organizations. In a security landscape where you must fight AI with AI, the best AI protection comes from having the best data. Zscaler has extended its Zero Trust architecture with powerful AI engines that are trained and tuned by 500 trillion daily signals. Learn more about Zscaler Zero Trust plus AI to prevent ransomware and AI attacks. Experience your world secured. Visit zscaler.com/zerotrustAI.
Hello, and welcome to Spycast, from the secret files of the International Spy Museum in Washington, D.C. I'm Dr. Vince Houghton, the museum's historian and curator. Every month, the museum brings you interesting talks with authors, scholars, and practitioners who live in the world of global espionage. Join us as we take a closer look at the secret world of intelligence.
So we are joined today with Dr. Jim Green, who is the director of the Planetary Sciences Division at NASA. Welcome, Dr. Green. Thank you for being here.
I'm delighted. Thank you.
So what we want to talk about today, other than your day job at NASA, is you are an expert in Civil War balloon reconnaissance. We'll get to that in a second. Let's talk a little bit about your day career.
Okay.
A little bit about your background. You received your PhD from the University of Iowa in space physics? Is that
correct?
Astrophysics?
Correct.
Or is there
a
difference?
It's actually doing... a variety of astrophysics and planetary science and even earth science from spacecraft.
Okay. And you've worked at NASA since right after you got your PhD
right.
in 1980.
More than 30 years.
You've worked your way up now into the director of this division. What does your division do?
Well, we manage at the highest level all our planetary missions. So any spacecraft that leaves the Earth and doesn't observe the Earth or doesn't observe the stars in the galaxy or the sun, that's planetary sciences. So we have spacecraft at Mercury, we have spacecraft flying around Mars in addition to the rovers. So the rovers on Mars, Opportunity and Curiosity, are planetary sciences ones. And we're going to be flying by Pluto next year. And we've got Cassini at Saturn and we're flying around the asteroid belt right now.
You don't lose Pluto because it's not a planet anymore?
Yeah, well, so. In reality, Pluto's a very fascinating object. We call it a dwarf planet because, indeed, it's a member of an entire population of objects from Pluto well beyond Pluto that are completely new to us.
Are you also involved with the Kepler system of exoplanets? You must have been pretty busy when they found the Goldilocks planet that's very Earth-like. Out in the middle of nowhere.
Well, what they found was a planet that's Earth-sized. We don't know if it's Earth-like exactly. But in planetary science, we look at all the atmospheres of all the planets. We understand all the physics and we go after about the geology and the ocean worlds. And so what we're learning in planetary science is actually helping the astronomers as they find these exoplanets as to what to look for next. As an example, we took one of our spacecraft called Deep Impact, and it takes measurements of light at various colors, various frequencies, and so we flew it well away from the Earth, and we had it look back at the Earth such that it was very small, one pixel, we call it, and then we took a spectrum of it. And so that's a spectrum of a planet that has life. It's Earth. And so it became the Rosetta Stone. We now have that spectrum. But as we observed Earth, what we found is that that spectrum changed. It changed based on how much land was there, how much ocean was there, how many clouds were there. So whatever we were looking at, we watched the change in that spectrum. And then it changed again when the moon moved in front of it. So now we have a whole set of information that can we can use in the next step of exoplanets, of finding Earth-like planets. If we can see the atmospheres and we can see changes and we can identify then ocean and land and maybe even moons. So we're ready for that big next step.
It's really like IMINT, like what the intelligence agencies do with imagery intelligence, where they look at pictures of things they know so they can compare them to things they find in the future.
That's, exactly.
That's fascinating.
Exactly.
You're also, as we talked about, a balloon reconnaissance expert. What made you interested in Civil War era balloon reconnaissance?
Well, it actually started very young. My grandmother got me a beautiful picture book of the Civil War. It was by Bruce Catton. It was American Heritage picture book for my 12th birthday, and she gave it to me, and she said, "Your great-grandfather, my father, was in the Civil War." And I, wow! You know, and so as I looked through the book and saw the battles, I wanted to know more about the Civil War, and I was really hooked on the Civil War from then on. And then, of course, as I got into spacecraft, which is the higher ground, which is doing remote reconnaissance, which is all those things that are exciting to me as a scientist, when I discovered that balloons were used in the Civil War, I just had to know more.
So
I've been, a natural transition. I've been studying it now for about 20 years.
So we've got pictures of it in the museum, and maybe people have seen pictures of the balloons during the Civil War, but these aren't the balloons you'd see today. These aren't hot air balloons
Correct.
That you'd ride around on a
Correct.
Summer day. What is actually causing these balloons to rise?
Okay, so these are hydrogen-filled balloons. It's actually molecular hydrogen, it turns out. This is very light, you know, and it can be generated in the field. You know, Thaddeus Lowe, the chief aeronaut, was an incredible engineering genius. So he created a method to generate hydrogen in the field with his gas generators. And so he also invented the type of balloon, a military balloon, the very first one that was ruggedized to be able to withstand variations in weather. Also, he coated the balloons so that they were nearly what we would call tight, you know, so that the molecular hydrogen only seeps out. The importance of these balloons are, once they're filled, they could last for 3, sometimes 4 weeks.
Ooh.
And so they could observe 24 hours a day if they wanted to. And in fact, they observed, you know, sometimes 10, 15 hours and more a day. They observed during the day, but they also observed at night. And when they observed at night, they wanted to know where the Confederate Army was. And so when they would go up, they would count the campfires.
Right.
Okay? And so locations of where those campfires were and where they weren't, told them what roads the army is camped on. Also, the number of campfires, because they knew in a campfire you could get about 10,
right.
10 Confederate soldiers around it. And so they could estimate army strength.
These kind of balloons actually predate the Civil War a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
The ideas go as far back as the mid-18th century. I mean, after Henry Cavendish discovers hydrogen, very quickly thereafter, people realize that there might be some lift capabilities of this.
Mm-hmm.
And in my research, 1780s was really the first flights. And even during the French Revolutionary period,
mm-hmm.
they were used in battle, or
yeah.
at least used as a reconnaissance platform.
Mm-hmm.
And really, as you mentioned already, that the Thaddeus Lowe's real innovation was finding out how to make hydrogen in the field. So it turns out that's why the French stopped, because they don't have the ability to do that. Can you talk a little bit about how these were integrated into the Union Army? I mean, you mentioned it a little bit. You talked about Thaddeus Lowe also, but how does he convince the Union Army that this is a new innovation that can be beneficial?
Yeah, so at the outbreak of the Civil War, Lincoln was very worried about Washington, D.C. And the reason why is a significant part of Maryland was very sympathetic to the Confederacy, although Maryland stayed in the Union. A lot of people in southern Maryland would have loved to have had Maryland go to the Confederacy. And, of course, across the Potomac is Virginia and the rest of the Confederacy. And so Lincoln always felt that a Confederate army could easily get across the Potomac and take control of Washington, D.C. So he was really concerned about this. The newspapers also fed into the fear of an invasion from the Confederacy. Now, during that time, early part of the Civil War, the Confederacy wanted to be left alone, and they hadn't been planning on any invasions of Washington, D.C., or the Union. But you know, that wasn't well known. It was always that fear. And then, so Lincoln was bringing in troops, but, you know, sometimes that's not enough. And so many of the newspapers were also really producing glowing reports of, well, these are the things you can do from balloons. And so that was causing a lot of aeronauts to stream into the Washington, D.C. area. In fact, Burnside from Rhode Island was so excited about balloons, he contacted one of the incredible aeronauts of the era, James Allen, and encouraged James Allen to join the 1st Rhode Island Infantry with his balloon. Actually, James took two balloons. And so they came down into the Washington, D.C. area. And so he, as a brigade commander, had his own balloon in addition to his infantry forces. That was going on at the time. Lowe came down and tried to get the Army excited about what he was doing and found that he was not very successful. The Army at the time was managed by Scott, Winfield Scott, who wasn't really up on the latest balloon technologies, and so he wasn't that interested in it. But Lowe had a good friend here in the D.C. area, which was Joseph Henry. Joseph Henry was the director of the Smithsonian at the time. And so Joseph Henry was really Lincoln's science advisor. And they didn't know each other very well, but he did take the opportunity to take Lowe over to the White House, introduce him to President Lincoln, and had a conversation about how balloons could be used. And indeed, Lowe, who's not only a fabulous engineer, he's quite the salesman. And he was selling Lincoln on the importance of balloons. So Lincoln authorized, through Joseph Henry, about $250 to do a balloon demonstration on the Mall. And so Lowe, who had one of his balloons with him, the Enterprise, came up with one-upsmanship. This is the kind of guy he was. All right, and so he decided the best way to get Lincoln's attention and really demonstrate what a balloon could do was to fly a telegraph operator up with him from a tethered balloon off the National Mall, okay, right at the site where the Air and Space Museum is today, actually. And so Lowe went to the gasworks, and it turns out the gasworks generate carbonated hydrogen, which streams through the town to turn on your gas lights. That's how you lit your house. When you walk into a house, you don't turn on a light.
Right.
You turn on your gas, and then you light the gas. And that's lighter than air. And so that was where the American Indian Museum is today.
Okay.
So it was very easy for Lowe to fill his balloon, grab the telegraph operator, and even the operator supervisor absolutely had to go along. And then actually hired a number of soldiers that were in the area to hold the tether lines. And he went up about 500 feet, and he sent Lincoln a telegram. And that telegram, the contents of that, was all over the United States in terms of the newspapers. You could get it in Philadelphia Inquirer and the New York Times.
Right.
And Lincoln loved it and invited Lowe back over to the White House to discuss it. So Lincoln really knew the values of balloons and wanted in the Army, and actually forced Winfield Scott to take him on.
There's actually a story from later that year in September where Lowe is an innovator in another sense, is that he ascended to more than 1,000 feet near Arlington across the Potomac and actually was able to telegraph intelligence about the Confederate positions all the way out in Falls Church, which is about 3 miles mm-hmm. away, mm-hmm. allowing Union guns that couldn't see where the Confederates were to fire on the Confederate Army without ever mm-hmm. ever looking at them. And he was directing that artillery
Correct.
Fire. Really the first indirect fire in warfare
mm-hmm.
history.
Right.
You know.
And he was very successful at that. He did that actually across Chain Bridge and just went into Virginia. And it was from that position where he could actually direct the artillery fire. Now, unfortunately, he didn't have a telegraph with him at the time, but he used flags and he would drop messages off the balloon. They would go down little bitty guy wires, and then the messages could be sent to to where the artillerists were. Low did that a couple times in the Civil War. He did it again on the peninsula. And every time he did it, it was tremendously successful. It was just fabulous demonstration of what you could do from the high ground.
Right.
Now, the other thing that is probably not very well known is Low was asked to have one of his balloons, and he built seven of them for the Army, specifically military observing balloons, to go out to the Mississippi and observe what was happening up and down the Mississippi, because the Union Army wanted to get down and cut the Confederacy in half. That was part of one of the major plans that the Union Army had. If we could take everything along the Mississippi, we split the Confederacy nearly in two. And so he sent one of his best aeronauts, who's John Steiner. John Steiner spoke broken English. He was still very German. And that was a problem. He had communication problems. But finally, Steiner was able to go up into a balloon and observe a major Confederate fortress called Island Number 10. It sat in the middle of the Mississippi River and would not allow the Union to go by it. Hmm. So when Steiner went up to see the island, he also noticed that the big mortars that were firing at the island were missing it by several hundred yards. And so when Steiner helped direct the artillery, Island Number 10 fell within another week or so, blew open the Mississippi until they got down to the Vicksburg area. So every time they used artillery spotting, it worked perfectly. What's truly amazing is that they didn't use it more.
Right. I mean, it seems like, I mean, we'll talk a little bit about, all of a sudden it ends, and there's several reasons why, but yeah. It seems like this could have been a way to win the war very quickly, not get your troops in harm's way. You could
right.
just sit back, guide the artillery fire, and just blast away
right.
at the Confederacy. Speaking of rivers, and actually a great segue into what I was going to ask you about next, from my research, it appears as though they developed early aircraft carriers.
Yes, they did.
That was fascinating.
Actually, it was believed to be the first aircraft carrier. Yeah, so when Low finally became chief aeronaut, you know, he could do no wrong. It was a blank check for him. So he told McClellan, who was then took over from Winfield Scott, that I need 7 or 8 balloons. And so McClellan allowed him to build these specialized balloons. And they were called the Union, the Intrepid, the Washington, the United States. You know, beautiful patriotic names, and he would paint them. They weren't gray, or they weren't blue, or they weren't whitish, and they weren't supposed to blend into the sky. They were supposed to be seen by anybody on the ground, okay? So the balloons provided a lot of intimidation. The idea was if you were a Confederate, you could see the balloon. The assumption was, well, then the balloon could see me,
right?
And so Low wanted that to happen, and he was tremendously effective in doing that. One of the other things he recognized is Lincoln indeed wanted to see observations up and down the Potomac. From a balloon at 1,000 feet, you could see 15 miles. An army moves 15 miles in a day. So from a balloon, right off the bat, you can see an army coming. You'll have a whole day to take that intelligence and get ready for a potential battle. And that was just perfect. So then Low had the opportunity to have several stations up and down the Potomac where balloon observations could be implemented, looking over in Virginia and keeping Washington, D.C. safe, at least a day away from being safe. And he was tremendously effective. So he actually went to the Navy Yard, where he actually had his gas generators built, and got the approval from McClellan to have a balloon boat, if you will. And so he ended up selecting a boat that was actually taken over from Arlington. Lee owned it, okay? And the name of the vessel was called G.W. Park Custis.
Well,
Right. And it was associated with the Arlington Plantation, and it moved material up and down the Potomac and was used for quite a few years. Lincoln had the superstructure Lowe had the superstructure taken off the top of it. He had it planked, and then from that flat deck, he could actually put his gas generators on board, inflate a balloon, and make an observation. And then it was towed. And he used it actually quite effectively up and down the Potomac.
So aircraft could take off from a ship.
Yeah. The balloon could take off from the ship.
Fantastic.
And that made it a portable observation platform too.
Right.
So the first time he really put it into effect was when he established a balloon station at what's called Bud's Ferry, which is down the Potomac, a fairways. A ferry is where you would cross the Potomac where two roads on either side of the river met, and you had a ferry operator moving materials back and forth. And so it was a perfect place to be able to set up a balloon station. And Hooker was placed in command of Bud's Ferry. And so Lowe took, in November 1861, his newly created aircraft carrier, the G.W. Park Custis, had it towed down in that area and actually made observations off it with the balloon Washington.
Fantastic. I live in this area, as you do also, and you don't have that history that you understand. Mm-hmm. It's really interesting to hear about all this real innovative, truly the first aerial reconnaissance platform. Mm-hmm. What I found also interesting from what I've researched is the countermeasures that the Confederacy put into place. You couldn't hit it once it was at altitude. The cannon just didn't have the opportunity, so they shot at it while it was low to the ground. Mm-hmm. But some of the camouflage and deception plans that the Confederacy put into practice were pretty innovative,
sure.
If you think about it.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, they would go out of their way in troop movements to be hidden from balloons. So, when there are battle plans, an army is spread over a large area, and different parts of the army, called corps, were to attack at certain times of the day. Not only did watches have to be synchronized, but they failed to do that most of the time. The ability to get your army in place before you made your attack was also critical. There's many battles that absolutely failed because of those logistical things of getting in the right place at the right time. And so if you weren't going to be observed by balloons, you had to make your trek along the road so that you wouldn't be observed, and then to bring up your army, and you had to move them quickly. So some of these movements were really well out of the way. And in fact, several Confederate high-ranking officers hated the balloons for that purpose. So that was a critical element of the balloon story. Well, Lowe made news all the time. He loved the reporters. He catered to the reporters. So when the reporters would come up and they needed a place to stay, he invited them into his tents. And rumor has it that he fed them, and he fed their horses using government supplies, which would be a no-no. In fact, he was investigated for that. Turned out he was exonerated. But in any event, what he would do then is, in trade, is take them up in a balloon. And they would write fabulous stories about balloons and their observations in it. And so, in fact, some of the most beautiful things written about observations are actually written by reporters that end up indeed in their columns on newspapers up and down the East Coast. And just some really, really wonderful things. The problem is, Lowe could take a reporter up from the New York Times who would then telegraph back his report. The next day or two, it would appear in the New York Times. And two days later, Lee is reading it.
All right?
And that's because the soldiers love to trade papers. I want to read the Richmond Dispatch, and here's the New York Times. And so it was really quite obvious to Lee and his generals early on that the fabulous intelligence that was coming from the balloons, some of which gets reported in the papers, gave him pause about, well, we've got to take that into account. So that's one of the reasons why they did their movements. But they also, as I mentioned, at night, would house a series of troops in locations where they were forbidden to have campfires.
Okay.
Or they would create campfires but not be in those areas.
Right.
Only because they knew the balloons were out there making observations of that area.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so that was not well known. You know, the Union couldn't figure that out sometimes. And so this was such a new set of technology with the latest information capability about it. But the ability for those generals to be able to assimilate what was happening and then respond back was lacking. It really took, you know, several decades as you got closer to World War I, mm-hmm. for them to recognize how to interpret the balloon reports. In fact, a lot of the criticisms that Lowe would get is that, well, he's not an officer, he doesn't know what he's looking for. And it turns out Lowe made hundreds and hundreds of flights, was up with some of the best officers. You know, in fact, Porter, Fitzjohn Porter,
right.
One of the most fabulous, generals in McClellan's army at the time, was up in the balloon all the time.
And he actually has a very interesting story.
He does.
I guess it's the first untethered balloon reconnaissance flight.
For a general.
For a general, okay.
Yeah, for a general. But indeed, they're up there for hours. What are they going to talk about? Lowe is going to tell Porter how the balloon works. Porter's going to tell Lowe what to look for.
Right.
So Lowe actually had, and his aeronauts actually had the ability to create the intelligence needed. The problem was, from a commanding general point of view, what are the questions we needed to know from the balloons? They couldn't formulate them. When you go up and you take the high ground and you have the whole countryside and you're looking at hundreds of roads, perhaps, in different directions, you know, going through fields and farms and valleys and streams and everything about the area, you can't possibly report everything. But if you had targeted questions, I want to know what's happening in this sector over this period of time, and then the balloonist could actually zero in on that and create the intelligence necessary that could be actionable.
Right.
So the problem really was the lack of real ability from the generals to recognize how important the balloons actually could be. And that ended up still being its downfall. It wasn't recognized as Lowe and his crew still used balloons well into 1863, how important the balloons really could be, hadn't been greatly important other than the few things we mentioned, but they still had tremendous opportunities, but because the generals were really closed mind about it, they let the balloon corps fade away.
It seems the Confederacy even tried.
Oh, yeah.
The interesting, relatively famous names I ran into was Porter Alexander, who people might know because he led the artillery at Gettysburg for the mm-hmm. Confederates.
Right.
He was an early balloon pioneer for the Confederacy. Mm-hmm. What made them run into issues? What was their issue? Why didn't they not continue their balloon reconnaissance?
There's a lot to be said about the cost of the Balloon Corps. It was an expensive proposition. But the way the Confederacy implemented observations by Porter Alexander, who's a fabulous individual, and played a major role in many battles for Lee, was very effective, actually. They used trains. They didn't have aircraft carriers, but they used trains. They would fill their balloon with illumination gas at Richmond, which was sitting right next to the train yard, and then put it on a flat car, and then run it down the peninsula, and then go up in a tethered balloon from there. And in fact, there's at least one major battle where there are one Confederate and two Union balloons up at the same time. And so they're all looking down at the battle and looking at each other.
But the Confederate Army really also were more concerned about how the Union was using the intelligence than they were thinking how they could use the intelligence. Lee tried with indeed Porter Alexander to get some information, did get some good information, but then once they lost that balloon, the balloon was called the Gazelle originally. It was made of a dress silk that came from England with beautiful patterns. It was also called by the Union Army the silk dress balloon, but the Confederate Army largely called it the Lady Davis. Okay, but once they lost that balloon, actually it was it was captured off the James River on the boat called the Teaser.
And one of the capturing ships, I believe, was the Ironclad, the Union Ironclad, the Monitor.
Yeah, it was the Monitor.
That was interesting.
Yeah, the Monitor and the Montauk. Yeah. So indeed, when Lowe got a hold of that balloon, he loved it. He cut it up in little squares, handed it out to congressmen. It was really, you know, here's the Confederacy balloon, you know, and he really made hay with that. Now, what's also quite fascinating is in the Battle of Gaines Mill, Confederate Army overruns a balloon station, and Lowe had his men packed the balloons to get out of there, but they couldn't get everything out. And the Confederate Army actually captured two of these gas generators in that battle. And they brought them back to Richmond, stored them in a warehouse, and put one of them on display in the square, Richmond Square, so that everyone could see, you know, that the balloons weren't as big a threat as everyone in Richmond was all upset. You know, but you would go out during the day and you'd look up and you'd see a Union balloon. You would see one of Lowe's beautiful Union balloons. Now, that was pretty scary. That means the Army's not that far away.
Well, the Soviets shot down Francis Gary Powers in the U-2, put it on display. Yeah, that's lots of
same,
parallels.
Same, yes,
same
that's
basic
right.
idea.
So it was a way to calm the population down that, you know, we're still going to win this. We're still in control. And even though they're using these advanced technologies, we're going to overcome. So that's what that said. But the Confederate Army had portable gas generators in their hands and didn't use them. So it's still a mystery on why they didn't pick that up. But it's got to be the general lack of knowledge in the upper part of the military to really understand what balloons could do if you use them right.
Right. It seems like one of the best advantages of these balloons that we haven't talked about yet is what we call geospatial intelligence, or understanding terrain and map making.
Right.
That was a real weakness of the Union when the war began, is the South not only had home field advantage because their population was there, but they knew the land. And most Northerners didn't really understand the land of the South. The balloons allowed them to revise their maps and understand that terrain much better than they had before.
In fact, when the Balloon Corps came into existence, it was put under the control of the topographical engineers. The whole idea from the Union Army is, the Union Army is made up of people from Michigan and New York and Ohio, and they're coming in, and none of them have been in Virginia, so they don't know what roads they want to go and where they need to be, etc. And so the topographical engineers would use the balloons a lot. In fact, on the peninsula, they were up in the balloons all the time, and they made fabulous maps, or they made those maps from what they knew from intelligence, but then corrected them from balloon observations. And in fact, you can go to the Library of Congress and pull out a couple books of maps made by the topographical engineers during the peninsula campaign that were largely done from with balloon information.
They passed that information down and hand wrote out the maps.
Well, they would take up the engineers.
Oh, the map engineers would go up.
Yeah.
And that leads me to a mystery that I don't quite understand. Is I know Matthew Brady, the very famous Civil War photographer, was very interested in balloons, and he was friendly with Lowe. And pictures had been taken in the past from a balloon, famously a Boston, a Paris. Why aren't there just reams of pictures of, you know,
Confederate soldiers or Confederate from balloons. Right. I mean, you would think they would go hand in hand.
That's a really interesting topic. And there might actually be a few photos. And here's how it shakes out. The picture, the first picture from a balloon was done in Boston, okay? And it was done in the aeronautic group of King and Allen. And that's James Allen, the same James Allen that was in Burnside's first Rhode Island infantry, and the same James Allen that when Lowe got to the peninsula, he hired him. He hired James Allen because he sent John Steiner to the Mississippi. So he was down an aeronaut, brought James Allen on. Well, James Allen, I know, was a big proponent of, hey, let's get a camera. And for whatever reason, Lowe hesitated a lot in that particular area. There were proposals that came into the Army about here's how a camera could be constructed and actually flown in a balloon and take images. But Lowe scoffed all those. Now, during the Peninsula Campaign, which is largely the summer of 1862, McClellan's army enters the peninsula in the March time frame and stays all the way into August. So a significant number of battles, fighting outside of Richmond. Lowe gets malaria. And so in July sometime, Lowe goes back to the United States to recoup, and James Allen takes over the Balloon Corps. You know, so he now is the chief aeronaut. Even though Lowe's father, who stays with the group, is the administrative head, Allen really was there. So one thing about Allen is, although he was an aeronaut all his life, you know, whereas Lowe was in and out of it, and this was the most important time for Lowe to be an aeronaut, Allen was not as prolific as Lowe. He didn't write about his experience all the time. So we don't know a lot about what happened during that month and a half or so that James Allen ran the Balloon Corps. But we do know this. When the Balloon Corps was pulled off the peninsula and brought back in August, back to Washington, D.C., there is a list in the National Archive of what was in the Balloon Corps, and in that was a whole set of photography equipment, okay?
So those pictures might be somewhere.
They might be somewhere. And so in a way, that's sort of the Holy Grail. If we could really identify images or you know, some letters or diaries which state that photography was done, that would be wonderful. But my bet is it was tried. It may have failed, but I bet Allen tried it. He was hot to do that.
So there were times when the Balloon Corps itself had a direct line to decision makers back in Washington during battles. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Lowe, during the Battle of Fair Oaks, had up with him a telegraph operator. And so he would observe what was happening right down on the ground. And then that was being sent back to McClellan's headquarters. And McClellan had the line that went back to the War Department here in Washington, D.C., right back to the telegraph office. And so as the story goes, it's been reported this way in New York Times, and I haven't been able to verify every point about it. But indeed, Lowe is making these observations, and Lincoln and Stanton sitting in the telegraph office in Washington, D.C., 100 or more miles away, was literally listening to the battle unfold from the balloon in those observation telegrams. And although I don't know if there was any chatter back and forth, and Lincoln and Stanton were only in the listen mode, indeed it gave them an opportunity to be able to observe what was going on in real time. Now, real-time information is critical in intelligence decisions. This happened in 1862. Almost 100 years later, in 1962, Kennedy is looking at the aerial photos, the YouTube photos of the missiles coming into Cuba, almost, you know, in the same way, getting near real-time intelligence, being able to see what was happening and was unfolding, hundreds and hundreds of miles away. Same basic concept.
Yeah, it really makes Lincoln able to be a real commander-in-chief, because he has this real-time information about the battlefield.
Well, Lincoln loved technologies. He really did. You know, he wrote it. He had his own patent of a boat to get over a sandbar, actually. So he loved he loved this kind of stuff. He spent an inordinate amount of time in the telegraph office. Walk across the street into the Winer building, go up the stair, walk into the telegraph room, and sit down, and they would say, okay, this is the stack you haven't read. And he would literally read what was happening, you know, from his armies in Missouri, in Kentucky, in Tennessee, in addition to what was happening in Virginia, and of course in Pennsylvania and in North and South Carolina. So he really was using the telegraph in a modern way. He really was obtaining that intelligence from those remote locations and getting a sense, a feel on a daily basis of how well things are going. You know, are we really winning? And so his insight was indeed as a chief commander. He was getting the intelligence to understand the entire layout of the war.
Hydrogen had been used even after the war, certainly, in balloons. I guess the reason that people started moving away from it is a very famous incident that happens in the early 20th century. It wasn't the Hindenburg, a hydrogen-based blimp? Hydrogen became incredibly difficult and flammable to work with.
Yeah, it turns out it wasn't too long after the Civil War, the French decided, hey, let's find out if we should be reintroducing balloons into our military. And of course, they gathered all the information they could from the American Civil War. You know, there were French observers in the army. And so they created their own little balloon corps themselves. And so they launched balloons with hydrogen, and then they would fire their cannon at them, and they blew them up. And that ended it.
Right.
So not too long after the Civil War, the French realized, hey, this is not a good idea, okay? So parachutes weren't invented. You didn't jump out of a balloon with a parachute. If you got hit in a balloon, you were going down. It was death. But indeed, Lowe and his crew were really quite lucky. Now, in the 3 years or so that the Balloon Corps was in existence in the Union Army, and they made well over 3,000 flights. I mean, they would make 10 or 11 flights a day and sometimes have three or four balloons even near one battlefield, and all seven of them sometimes were deployed up and down the Potomac, as I mentioned earlier. And so with that many flights, how come there weren't any accidents? As you mentioned earlier, as the balloon goes up, the first 300 feet is a killer. So the Confederate Army would be on the wait, waiting for the balloon to go up and just pour artillery and shots at it. And in fact, there's a number of stories for which shells actually went between the gondola and the balloon, you know, through the webbing that was holding the gondola to the balloon. But as I said, they were very lucky. However, there was one accident. And that accident occurred right after Chancellorsville. And here's where Lowe had actually quit the Balloon Corps and went home. It was turned over as chief aeronaut to James Allen. By that time, James Allen, Lowe actually had hired James Allen's brother, Ezra Allen. And so at Chancellorsville, at the end, it was just Ezra Allen and James Allen as the two major aeronauts. Hooker wanted observations, demanded that there be observations. And so Ezra went up in the balloon, Washington, and tethered lines would go 1,000 feet. And the story goes that the entire 1,000 feet was let out, and he was no more than 500 feet in the air. Hmm. So the balloon was being blown by an enormous wind, you know, which is really pushing the balloon back to the ground. And that was so strong that it actually ripped the seam of the balloon. And so a huge seam was ripped. The gas was being emitted rapidly, and the balloon was going to rocket it down to the Earth. And even at 500 feet, it's not survivable in general. But the group that was holding on to the tethered lines was the fourth main. And the fourth main had been with the Balloon Corps actually quite a bit. And they were really expert at it. And so they recognized that if they ran upwind with their lines, then the balloon wouldn't come straight down, but actually would come down in an angle and glide down. And that's what they did. And Ezra Allen survived that. And they repaired that balloon, and that balloon was used even after the war for many years.
There seems to be an unbelievable amount of innovation with just this one relatively small. You have innovations in aeronautics. You have innovations on the intelligence side with imagery intelligence and signals intelligence and geospatial intelligence. I mean, across the board, this is a collections platform that can do almost everything, certainly more than you associate with the Civil War as intelligence. And what I found really interesting, and this is not the Civil War, but we still actually use balloons today in many combat operations in Afghanistan. Now, they're unmanned. We're not sending people up there.
Sure.
But they're still acting as with cameras and sensors and other things. I mean, this technology that was developed was so innovative that it's still not obsolete today.
Well, NASA even uses balloons. We use balloons, high-altitude balloons, to be able to get well above the atmosphere such that we can, but not leave the Earth. We can't leave the Earth with a balloon, but get above where most of the atmosphere is at, and that allows us to look out into space at wavelengths of light that don't actually make it to the ground. And those are really important flights. And we do many of those actually a year and a half for nearly most of NASA's life. But even the human exploration portion of NASA uses balloons. And they're weather balloons, or they're wind balloons. What they do is they'll launch balloons at a certain height to be able to gain the information to know the weather conditions before they launch.
Okay, yeah.
You know, you want your shuttle or your rocket unimpeded through the atmosphere, and some of these wind currents can be extremely strong. And so you end up with wind shear and all kinds of problems that, you know, you want to avoid that. And so you get the information literally from balloons and gather that data and then say, okay, we're ready to launch.
So you're part of a local group of, for lack of a better word, reenactors who reenact these balloon reconnaissance missions. Is that right?
Yes. I wouldn't call it an extensive group, but we have a nice little core group. I portray James Allen, and also I'm in period dress. Kevin Knapp is Thaddeus Lowe, and he is just perfect for that. We do actually launch small balloons. We've been on a whole variety of battlefields, and we've been in many different events. In fact, during the 150th celebration of Chancellorsville, we actually launched a particular balloon when the reenactment was going on, the pictures of that were just perfect. It was actually not a huge balloon, it was a very tiny balloon, but we were pretty close to the battlefield. And so we had it up, and it was, you know, everything about it was just right. So we really enjoyed that. We've been doing that now for a year and a half or so.
That's really living the history, because you get a chance to see what they saw that day on the battlefield.
Right.
And that's something a lot of people who study intelligence don't get a chance to do, is actually go where their predecessors were during that time. That's absolutely fascinating.
Now, just recently, I was at the dedication for State of Virginia recognizes the importance of Pohick Church, not only from the history of the fact that it was a church that Washington built and went to, but also it was a fabulous balloon station where Lowe went and made some important observations that showed the retreat of the Confederate Army, which allowed McClellan in March 1862 to launch his Peninsula campaign. Lowe also from that location tested balloons. He had two very small balloons that he built, the last two, the Eagle and the Excelsior, and those were one-man balloons that you could quickly inflate and get up and make an observation, you know, very quickly, and were just perfect balloons for that. And he tested those and got them working at Poet Church.
Well, it's good to see that they're starting to get some recognition.
It really is. It
took 150 years, but at least they're there.
That was a fabulous, fabulous little celebration.
Fantastic. Is there any contact information for your reenactment? Is there a website for your reenactment group? Is there a way that people who live in the neighborhood can find out when you're going to be doing something next?
Yeah, typically what happens is when a notice of a reenactment will occur, they will list the units that will be there. And if that's one that we can make, then you'll see Thaddeus Lowe's Balloon Corps.
Okay.
That's really the best place.
That's absolutely fascinating. Dr. Green, I appreciate you coming here and talking to us about this. This is this will really make a difference for us in this museum because it's information that we know. It's so integral to the intelligence picture of the United States and of the Civil War. And of, you know, anytime talking about aerial surveillance, this is an integral part of that story. So I appreciate you coming and talking to us today. I'd like to thank you from the International Spy Museum, and please come back anytime.
My pleasure.
Absolutely. Thank you very much, sir.
You're very welcome.
We look forward to continuing this dialogue with you, and we'd like to know if you have any comments or questions on today's SpyCast. You can get in touch with us through email at spycast@spymuseum.org. Thank you, and we will see you next month.